The results are in North Carolina and Indiana. Are we there yet? Do we have a Democratic presidential nominee?
I win. He wins. I win. He wins. It's so close.
Is it? Senator Hillary Clinton said those two primaries would be a game changer, perhaps not the one she's hoped for. Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 7th, and this is The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It was a narrow win for Senator Clinton in Indiana and a big victory in North Carolina for Barack Obama. What is the game now for the Democrats between now and June? Is it about superdelegates, the remaining primaries, wheeling and dealing for Florida and Michigan? The options narrow from here on out. Also, the latest from Burma, a milestone for Israel, and all the news. International aid has begun to be delivered to Myanmar, also known as Burma. The country was hit by a tropical cyclone over the weekend. Officials say the storm left more than 22,000 people dead, 41,000 people missing. A BBC reporter working undercover in Burma says the government doesn't have the resources to deal with the disaster alone.
The fear is that the longer the aid groups are delayed, the worse the risk of disease taking hold in a country with an already fragile healthcare system.
The notoriously isolated Burmese government has held up visas for international aid workers. The chair of the House Committee of Veterans Affairs had harsh words for the department. California Democrat Bob Filner said yesterday the agency has been covering up the growing problem of suicides among veterans.
We are witnessing either an inability to address this problem or a purposeful attempt to minimize the problems faced by veterans and the VA and sweep this epidemic of suicides under the rug.
An internal email with the subject line, shh, surfaced from the department's mental health director, Ira Katz. It indicated Katz knew about the 12,000 veterans per year who attempt suicide while under department treatment.
Last night, a Georgia man became the first inmate put to death since the United States Supreme Court ruling last month supporting the constitutionality of lethal injections. William Lind was convicted of killing his 26-year-old girlfriend in 1988. Executions had been on hold since September after the justices agreed to review a challenge to Kentucky's procedures, similar to those in roughly three dozen states, including Georgia.
Yahoo shareholders are now threatening to sue or boot out the company's board for refusing Microsoft's $47.5 billion offer. Yahoo corporate officials have been trying to raise doubts about the legitimacy of Microsoft's last bid by pointing out it wasn't submitted in writing. Oil hit a record near $123 per barrel in Asian markets today. The Dow rose 51 points yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 1418. And we have more news from Femi Okeh later in the hour. And America has answered the call from The Takeaway.
Remember the little engine that could. Hillary Clinton's just as good.
My name is Stan Elias. I'm calling from West Barnstable. And my suggestion for one of Obama's slogans is, join the Obama-rama. Thank you.
Those are suggestions coming from folks all over to our question today, which is the contest for the Democratic nomination is just seeming to be an endless process. We think it's time for a campaign slogan to get a makeover.
Can you rebrand the campaign? And you can call 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us your campaign slogan at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we told you, Barack Obama won a double-digit victory in North Carolina last night, and Hillary Rodham Clinton won a narrower victory in Indiana. Barack Obama picked up the delegate majority after last night's two primaries. Joining us now is Howard Wolfson, Communication Director for the Clinton campaign. Thanks for joining us, Howard, and congratulations on the victory.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Lanny Davis, a colleague of yours, was on one of the cable networks last night, and he seemed to be explicitly laying out what he described as the main argument of the Clinton campaign at this point, and that is to convince superdelegates to support Hillary Clinton because Barack Obama is a lesser candidate, a weaker candidate in November. Is that the strategy of the campaign this morning?
Well, look, the strategy is the following. We have 7 more contests between now and June 3rd. We need to do well in those contests. Next week is West Virginia. We think we're going to do well there. We obviously have to do well. And then Oregon and Kentucky and Puerto Rico and Montana and South Dakota after that. We want to make sure that Florida and Michigan are seated. We don't believe that this nominating process can be complete without the delegates from Florida and Michigan. Those are primaries that we won. We think those delegates ought to be seated.
And Lanny Davis was mentioning the Florida and Michigan issue last night quite repeatedly.
And, of course, we are going to continue to make the case that Senator Clinton would be a better nominee against John McCain and would be a better president. We obviously wouldn't be doing this if we didn't think that those things were true.
All right, my question about that as a strategy, though, is it seems that no longer is the American people and the primary contest the forum for deciding how these delegates are going to vote. The arithmetic for the remaining delegates in the primaries can't give you the nomination here. So my question is, what is the forum for deciding who's going to be the nominee for the Democratic Party? Is it going to be the convention? Is it going to be some meeting you have with superdelegates? Or is it going to be some sort of meeting with Howard Dean? Because it's certainly not the American people anymore.
That's a good question. I'm not sure I totally agree with the premise, because the contests in the upcoming states do have a tremendous impact on superdelegates and voters in future contests. So I do believe that both candidates will be contesting the upcoming contests. I do believe that the remaining primaries will get large turnouts. Advertising will be run in those states. There will be campaigns in those states. And so we will be talking directly to millions of voters, and I think that the results in those states will be important. But of course,
those results will not be the forum that decides this. I mean, you're basically saying this morning that it's going to be some sort of room that's behind the scenes where a deal is made if you're going to be the nominee. That's the only scenario now.
Well, actually, no, that is not true. The vote will take place in the light of day on the convention floor in Denver. That's not in any back room. That's on a floor with everybody voting and being counted. The decision to seat Florida and Michigan is totally transparent and public. The DNC will rule on that in public.
In the convention or before the convention?
Before the convention. There's actually going to be an adjudicatory process on May 31st, which could either decide it or just be another step in the process.
All right, Adora, you have a question?
Quick question for you, Howard. But essentially, if you're saying that it will be decided by the voters, I mean, you're looking at a very high percentage of the vote that Senator Clinton would have to get, 70% or better by most estimates, not only of the vote, but also of the superdelegates. Is that realistic?
Well, it's what we have to do. I mean, we are going to have to do well. There's no question about it. I do believe that we're going to start by doing well in West Virginia. It'll be a key test for both candidates. It's a swing state. It's a state that Democrats have won in the 90s but did not win in 2000 and 2004. We believe Senator Clinton will win it in 2008 if she is our nominee. And, you know, there's no question that we're going to have to do well there.
Howard Wolfson, we will have more in this program on the very likelihood, as you suggest, that Hillary Clinton will win in West Virginia. Howard Wolfson is Communications Director for the Clinton campaign. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yes, we know what's coming. I'm not naive. We've already seen it. The same names and labels they always pin on everyone who doesn't agree with all their ideas. The same efforts to distract us from the issues that affect our lives by pouncing on every gaffe and association and fake controversy in the hopes that the media will play along. The attempts to play on our fears and exploit our differences, to turn us against each other for political gain, to slice and dice this country into red states and blue states, blue collar and white collar, white, black, brown, young, old, rich, poor.
Both candidates' bases came out during the latest round of Democratic primaries last night. African-Americans, young people, and college-educated voters came out in force for Barack Obama in both Indiana and North Carolina. Hillary Rodham Clinton depended on working-class whites to propel her to victory in Indiana. David Wilhelm is an advisor to the Obama campaign, formerly a manager of Bill Clinton's campaign in years past. David, it was a tough week for Barack Obama, 2 weeks, I suppose we could say. And there was an anticipation earlier that perhaps that he would do better in Indiana. What happened?
What happened? Last night was a great night for Barack Obama. Given the media context of the preceding 2 weeks, I think underscores the point. He won by 15 percentage points, more than 200,000 votes in North Carolina. Indiana, the state that Senator Clinton thought she must do very, very well in, that she had to have the game changer, was anything but a game changer. So I think what happened last night was that Barack Obama took a huge step towards becoming the eventual nominee of the Democratic Party. We come out of North Carolina and Indiana with the magic number that will put Barack Obama over the top of 172 delegates. The math is becoming not just extremely difficult, it's virtually impossible for Senator Clinton at this point.
There was a lot of information that came out of the exit polls, as they usually do, and one that caught our eye was the greater percentage of Hillary Clinton supporters who said they wouldn't back Obama in the general election versus the other way around. Does that concern you moving forward, and how do you address that?
Well, my own view of that is that once we get in the context of a general election and the race is engaged in the framework of a general election, that Barack Obama's positions on health care, on Iraq, on the economy are going to represent such a stark difference to the positions of Senator McCain that I think those folks, while feelings may be bruised today, they're going to come back. And you look at some of the work that Senator McCain has done within his own party. Even yesterday, 25-26% of Republican primary voters voted against him. But you get a sense that Republicans are coalescing around him. We've got work to do. Mm-hmm. We need to be very sensitive to the point that you've raised. We need to be very aggressive about raising the bread and butter economic issues that matter in the lives of those working class voters. I think we'll do that, and in the context of a general election campaign, we'll do just fine.
Let's talk about Florida and Michigan for a moment. As you know well, the Clinton campaign is really pushing to get those delegates seated. What is the Barack Obama campaign's thought on that now?
Well, we really haven't changed our position from day one of the campaign, and that is that we're going to play by the rules. The rules were well known in advance by all parties and all participants, and Michigan and Florida violated those rules. So that election is invalid as in terms of providing insight into how those delegates ought to be allocated. But it is important that Michigan and Florida be full participants in the convention. And in conjunction with the national party and state and local party officials and elected officials, I think, and the Clinton campaign, I think we can sit down and hammer out a compromise that will allow those delegations to be seated.
Would you ever consider perhaps having the delegates seated in Florida and perhaps not Michigan, since Barack Obama was not actually on the ballot there in Michigan?
Well, I think both states are important, and my view and the campaign's view is that neither election was anywhere close to fully engaged, and especially at that point in the campaign when Barack Obama was less well known, he needed to have those full campaigns to mm-hmm. be competitive. So those elections should not, cannot be the starting point for those negotiations. I think we can figure it out.
Just a few seconds here, David.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. We're just running out of time. David Wilhelm, advisor to the Obama campaign, and I should add, a superdelegate. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're following the political results from last night in Indiana and North Carolina, and also the situation in Myanmar, also known as Burma. And we're also thinking about the Middle East today. Israel is a lot of things. It is certainly a place of intractable conflict and persistent instability, yet the Israelis are people of a long-standing intellectual tradition that does not hesitate at any time to take hard looks at its political system or itself. And Israel has a birthday tomorrow. It's 60 years old tomorrow, and celebrations are already beginning in Israel. And that was the occasion for political economist Bernard Avishai to take a good hard look at the legal system and the assumptions about the state of Israel 60 years ahead. His new book is called The Hebrew Republic, and we are very, very grateful that you came in this morning.
Thank you for asking.
And it's great to see you again.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a long, long, long time ago. I was in Israel on its 40th birthday. Much has happened in the last 20 years. Let's just get right to the point. One of the criticisms that you make or suggestions that you make is that Israel needs to consider a more straightforward secular approach to dealing with its ethnic demographic problems.
Yes.
And also its isolation in the Middle East. Can you explain?
Well, this raises two points, really, because there's good news and bad news. Most people who think about Israel think about it in terms of the peace process. That's all foreground. There's a background here. The good news in the background is that Israel has made a huge success of globalization.
It's a robust technological
very robust
economy.
There, yeah. Extremely strong. Really the Silicon Valley of the Middle East. It's got $150 billion GNP today. So it solved the biggest problem developing countries have to solve, which is how to succeed in the knowledge economy.
But from here on out, you say Israel is restrained by some of the most basic assumptions about its existence, including the fact that it is the Jewish state.
Right. And that's the sort of bad news is that, Israel's really two Jewish states. It's a Hebrew republic. It's a country that's fully democratic, state of its citizens, and reflects exactly what I just said before.
You're talking about the sort of liberal, moderate, secularized
Hebrew
Jews.
Version of the global thing.
Right,
Hebrew
right.
version of the global
that's
thing. Everybody's
one Jewish
equal.
State.
Everybody's
right.
equal. And it's patently a Jewish state, Hebrew speaking, and in fact assimilates all kinds of minorities into it.
What's the other Jewish state?
The other Jewish state is really the residual settler state, heroic settler state that was put together as the scaffolding for the Hebrew Republic, the scaffolding which was put up in the time of the British Mandate.
Which now finds itself in the middle of the controversy with the Palestinians of the West Bank. The settlement movement is perceived as acts of aggression in the West Bank and Gaza.
But I'm more concerned about Israel's own internal Arab population, which is almost 25%. If you look at the young people, almost 25% of the country. It's really 20% and growing to 25%. And, if the West Bank and Gaza were sort of relocated to the moon, Israel could have another intifada from its own Arab population in the next generation, precisely because its heroic settler state has never been retired and systematically discriminates against its own population.
Why so little success in granting political franchise to the Israeli Arabs, even though there is a degree of integration into Israeli society? I mean, Israeli Arabs do live among Israeli Jews to
right.
a certain extent,
and
but they have very few political rights, it seems.
Well, no, they have political franchise. They're completely equal before the law. They have the right to vote, and they vote actively.
But it hasn't gotten them much in 60 years.
That's because structurally the state of Israel, which is residual to the old heroic time, discriminates against them in land because, you know, something like 90% of the land of the country is administered by the Israel Land Authority that sees itself as a custodian for the Jewish people. A lot of material privileges are meant for Jews. The path to citizenship is largely defined through a legal definition of being part of Jewish nationality, being a Jew, and that's decided by an Orthodox rabbinate that's part of the state apparatus. Well, and so you have a whole series of residual institutions that systematically discriminate against non-Jews. And the Arabs have this foot on the brake, foot on the gas relationship to the Jewish population and are becoming extremely alienated and restive precisely because they're already third-generation Israelis and they've begun to feel that this is their country.
Personally, I mean, would you experience some pain in essentially calling for jettisoning the concept of the Jewish state on Israel's 60th birthday?
But I'm not calling for that. I'm not calling for jettisoning the Jewish state. I'm calling for a democratic state, which is patently Jewish in the sense that it retains the cultural links back to Jewish history. It speaks the Hebrew language and invites others to join that culture. So I don't see this in any way as calling for the elimination of a Jewish state. I'm talking about creating a state which is patently Jewish, but is Jewish in the way that states in the European Union, for example, are national states of their own.
Secular institutions, but a Jewish majority.
I'm talking about a Jewish cultural reality, which is politically, economically so powerful that other people will want to join it.
Quickly, 60th birthday, a happy one for Israel, in your view?
Look, it's whatever else you can say. The fact of Israel is an enormous achievement, and anybody who lives in that country can't help but feel grateful. So, you know, I think it's a happy time, but it's a sober time because, you know, we've lived with this kind of violence for a long time, and we want to be able to see an end to it.
Bernard, thank you very much. Political economist Bernard Avishai's new book is called The Hebrew Republic, talking about the future of the Israeli embrace of secularism in a nation that is 60 years old tomorrow.
Time for more headlines from Femi Okay.
In the news today at 29 minutes past the hour, we have aid agencies trying to get into Burma. Aid groups have asked the military government to waive their visa requirements. Colombia has extradited one of the country's most feared parliamentary warlords, Carlos Maria Jimenez, to the United States to face drug trafficking charges. Russia has inaugurated its new president, Dmitry Medvedev, this morning. His predecessor, Vladimir Putin, tomorrow becomes the country's prime minister. Sudan's census ends today, wrapping up an eventful 2 weeks. Some of the problems included monitors from the north being expelled from the south, Sudanese in Darfur refusing to be counted, and of course the ubiquitous rainy weather. But the head of census, Mr. Dr. Abdul Bargale Galini, thinks that 90% of Sudan has been covered.
Despite the challenges, despite the difficulties, despite the obstacles, the degree of coverage we have just reached it is quite acceptable to me.
Many people believe they haven't been counted, including Dr. Galini himself. And that's your news.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Politics, Democratic arithmetic, political math in a moment. But the contest for the Democratic nomination requires a makeover, we think, this morning. The Takeaway's challenge is create some slogans for the Clinton and Obama campaigns, like this one. Phil says the Clinton campaign should have Chelsea Clinton say this: vote my mama, not Obama. You can send your suggestions to 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Superdelegates.
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 The superdelegates.
The superdelegates.
The superdelegates.
Superdelegates, a big word these days. There are only six states left to vote in the Democratic primary, six states that add up to roughly 217 regular delegates. That, of course, depends on exactly which numbers you're relying on, but somewhere around there. That means that at least the estimated 220 superdelegates will still undecided take on an even greater importance, because based on these estimates right now, there are more superdelegates undecided than regular delegates.
They are so super.
And joining us to parse through all of this is Jeff Zeleny, our pal from the New York Times, and our pal Andrea Bernstein, who is the Takeaway political director. And let's start with you, Andrea. You heard Howard Wolfson earlier. What is the Clinton campaign doing to shape its message to party insiders to grab those superdelegates?
Well, it's pretty clear that they're going to be making the same argument that they have been making. The problem for them is these last 2 weeks were, in some sense, a laboratory for them. Obama had a bunch of very bad news cycles with the Reverend Wright affair. There was the issue of the gas tax, which Clinton thought would really gin up her support among working-class white voters. And what happened? The race ended the way it began, with the polls at the end of the race matching exactly where they were in Pennsylvania. So there did seem to be a period where he was dropping and she was going up, and then it came back to where it was. And that doesn't give her a lot of fodder for the argument that Obama can't weather trouble, because he did weather this, and he seems to have ended up exactly where he began. And she lost in some key counties in Indiana, the suburbs of Indianapolis, where I was last week, and she seemed to be doing well there. But these are affluent counties, and her argument that people who weren't for the gas tax were elitist, her sort of argument against the economists, which has not been a position she's taken for most of the campaign, the evidence suggests that there was a negative reaction against that, and Obama won those counties pretty handily. So not only did she not do as well as she'd hoped, but her argument may have actually backfired for her. And that makes it very tough in going for the superdelegate campaign, which is, of course, the biggest delegate prize remaining.
Jeff, Hillary Clinton won Indiana, but Barack Obama did quite well in North Carolina. And essentially, when you take a look at the numbers, he picked up somewhere around 95 delegates, whereas she only picked up somewhere around 76 delegates. Barack Obama is still ahead. Can she catch him?
Well, given the current primaries coming up, as you said, only six contests, she cannot catch him on the calendar. The only place she has a chance to is in the vast wasteland of superdelegates, if you will. But that becomes an increasingly uphill challenge for her because of the results of last night. So what the Clinton campaign is doing right now is saying, look, what about Florida and Michigan? They're taking the argument back once again that Florida and Michigan have to be factored into this. Of course, their delegates have not been included because they held their primaries before the party rules allowed. So if Senator Clinton is going to remain in this fight, which we think she is, she put out her schedule this morning. She's flying to West Virginia. She has a fundraiser tonight in Washington. She's flying to South Dakota tomorrow. All these places have primaries coming up. If she's going to continue, it is going to have to be, she'll have to get some relief from either Florida or Michigan, and the Democratic National Committee will decide that at the end of the month at a meeting in Washington.
Now, the bottom line is Barack Obama is still ahead in the delegate count, still ahead in the popular vote. Can we expect to see today, tomorrow, or in the next couple of days, some of these superdelegates coming out, perhaps in droves, but backing Barack Obama? Because the dynamics numerically just haven't changed, and we're getting down to the wire here.
I mean, I don't know if we'll see them coming out in droves or not, but the Obama campaign has been very skilled in always having a handful of these superdelegates, of these Democratic Party officials, sort of already, and even after some of his defeats in Pennsylvania and Ohio, they were still rolling some out. So the Obama aides that I am speaking with this morning are saying, yes, there will be some more today. And Senator Obama is going back to Washington later this afternoon. He'll be there all day tomorrow. He is going to begin meeting with these Democratic Party officials. And, you know, probably a week from now, even, you know, a few days from now, it looks like there will be more people in his column. But, again, the Clinton campaign believes in its argument that Senator Obama is a wounded general election candidate, largely because of his association with his former pastor, Reverend Wright. Mm-hmm. So they are still going to be making that argument. And if you look at some of the election returns around Indiana, around North Carolina, he did fail in some places to make this argument. So we'll see how it goes, but certainly Senator Obama has a stronger argument this morning to take to superdelegate.
But Andrew, you spent a lot of time in Indiana, and it just doesn't seem as if the Reverend Wright issue, which so many pundits predicted would really harm Barack Obama at the polls, it didn't seem to bother the voters so much.
Well, I think that there were voters that it did bother, but in the end, they came to their conclusion that they were going to vote for him anyway. I mean, I think there was sort of a sag in the middle of this race when Hillary Clinton looked like she was really pulling ahead. So I think that, you know, things did change. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting, if you look at the exit polls that were in the New York Times this morning, is that Obama won among economically distressed voters. He tied Clinton with people who said, he's like us. And that's the big card she's been playing. So if you're a superdelegate this morning, it's hard to think, what are the results telling me that are going to influence me to say that I was for Hillary Clinton today if I didn't say it yesterday? And that is the challenge. And when you were speaking with Howard Wolfson earlier, I think it was pretty clear that even he was saying, yes, you know, we have an uphill battle, but this race is almost over. 93% of the pledged delegates done, and I don't know how much longer that can be strung out.
It's almost over, but not quite, which is why Jeff Zeleny from the New York Times is still on the road. Thank you. I'm sure we'll be speaking to you soon, and Andrea Bernstein will continue covering the ins and outs. She's our Takeaway political director. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
And now it's time for some more headlines from Femi Oke.
Just a quick trip into the news this morning. It's 20 minutes to the hour. The country of Burma is still recovering from the weekend's tropical cyclone, which has now left 22,000 dead, and a new figure for the numbers of missing people, 41,000. Aid has already begun to arrive, with the US pledging $3 million and some naval support as well. And in China, President Hu Jintao vowed to continue talking with the Dalai Lama, but also suggested that the Tibetan spiritual leader is causing more problems than he's solving. He demanded that the Dalai Lama stop trying to incite violence and harm the upcoming Olympic Games in Beijing. Just a suggestion.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
America, as always, is looking for a few good bumper stickers. In this campaign, we need some new slogans. Can you help us, America?
Hi, guys. This is David from Putnam, Connecticut. I got Hillary Clinton's next slogan. Listen, folks, a lactose-free, biofuel-free, fossil fuel-free, zero carbon footprint, totally vegan, village-grown, ethnic and gender non-specific substance in every government-supplied pot. There you go. Thanks.
That's courtesy
that very
of
clever.
Spinbox 8778 My Take. I wonder how many takes he had to do of that. That was good. We should have him on the show. Anyway, that's our suggestion. You know, what is a good new slogan for these campaigns? You may have seen the campaign slogans last night being waved. I'm asking you to believe from Barack Obama's website, Clinton's website today, help make history. Here was Obama speaking last night.
Yes, we can.
Here's Hillary Clinton speaking last night.
It's full speed on to the White House.
And then, of course, there was this.
Count
count the votes, full speed onto the White House, change you can believe in. We want someone who's good at this, a professional, to deal with the slogans for these candidates. Josh Comers is a copywriter for Kaplan Thaler Group. He's worked on ad campaigns for Aflac, Continental Airlines, Centrum, and Foxwoods Casino. Help us out here. Help America out, Josh.
Well, I think Obama could actually, you know, I mean, I don't know what can help Hillary out right now. Short of a miracle, but I think Obama could maybe a behavioral change supported by some new slogans. Obama has a little issue with the working class right now,
right?
So I think what may help him is if he went back and took up smoking again heavily. and
he claims to have quit.
He claims to have quit, but I mean, I think at this point it may be helpful if he's never not in front of a camera with a cigarette not dangling out of his mouth.
And that would do what? How would you sloganize
well,
that?
Well, I think there's a couple ways you can do it. Welcome to Obama country. Come to where the change is. Maybe something a little nod to the old camel. I'd walk a mile for a vote. Something that really encapsulates Obama. Obama, smooth.
So, what about for Hillary? What do you think some of the issues are she's confronting, and how do you think she might sum that up in a nice little?
I have a couple of ideas, but for Hillary, the problems with the young. The young people, they love Obama. So Hillary, maybe some slogans that really speak to the younger voters. Hillary, this land is my space. This land is your space.
I like that. That's good.
That is a nice, succinct one. A vote for Hillary is a vote for universal Grand Theft Auto insurance.
I don't get it.
You don't get that
Grand
one?
Grand Theft
no.
Auto. Come
That's,
on.
Do you know I the get, Grand Theft Auto?
I do
such
know,
a phony.
I don't get that in relation to Hillary. How does that make
healthcare insurance?
It doesn't matter. It speaks to the young. That doesn't have to make that much sense.
So it doesn't have to make sense.
It fits
sense.
On a bumper sticker. What are you looking for here?
You're
looking for meat on this stick?
Josh Comers, thank you. One more takeaway response. We have a slogan from someone in Massachusetts, Martha Mahard. Why don't you give that one?
That's she says, favorite. Here's my suggestion for a slogan for the Democrats. United we can, divided McCain. Maybe a touch too downbeat, she says, but would be great on a bumper sticker.
William says via our website, Clinton will campaign for food. That's mean. That's a little mean.
That is harsh.
But fits on a bumper sticker.
Not helpful for her campaign.
Fits on a bumper sticker, yes, that's true. Collector's item.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Today is day 4 for the people in Myanmar, also known as Burma, as they sort through or continue to sort through the chaos wrought by Cyclone Nargis. As of now, government officials fear more than 22,000 people are dead and say that 41,000 people are missing. The numbers are really stunning. Officials also say that 24 million people lived in and around where the storm hit. They also say it wasn't the cyclone that devastated the southern part of the country. It was the tidal wave that followed. That's the first glimpse the military government has offered into what actually happened on Saturday. Meanwhile, humanitarian groups are struggling to get aid to hundreds of thousands of people in need. Richard Horsey from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs joins us. And Richard, what's happening today? Any movement, any more movement of getting some of that aid and people on the ground there in Myanmar?
Yes, relief flights have been getting in yesterday, today, and more flights will be coming in the coming days. The authorities are welcoming both bilateral and multilateral UN assistance, so we're starting to get quantities of goods into Yangon. The challenge remains getting the goods from there out to the populations in these remote and affected areas that desperately need them. That's a huge logistical challenge, and much more concerning than the challenge of getting goods to Yangon itself.
So at this point, it's just a question of being able to travel the roads which are blocked by trees and other debris, buildings and whatnot, as opposed to there being difficulty in getting, say, visas we've been reading about for people to go into the country?
Yes, the main logistical problem on the ground is indeed, as you say, getting those roads cleared and so on. But much more than that, in the sense that there's around 5,000 square kilometers of flooded area. And so most of the worst affected areas are completely underwater, accessible
still,
only by boat.
Still underwater.
Still underwater, yes. Accessible only by boat, and even helicopters can't land in some of these areas. So it is a huge logistical challenge. We have got a number of key staff waiting for the green light from the government, basically for visas. There are 30 to 40 key international staff who have experience of how to respond best in these kinds of situations, and we are hoping for a green light on that very quickly.
Do you have any sense of, can I just interrupt you there for a second? Do you have any sense of exactly how many people who are there to help with rescue efforts, cleanup efforts, assessment efforts? Do you have any sense of how many of those aid workers are actually on the ground, if we're talking about an area that affects 24 million people?
Well, indeed, 24 million is about half the population of the country. In fact, not all of those people are in the directly affected areas, but we do estimate that there are probably 1 million people in need of emergency assistance. So it is a huge operation. UN agencies and international relief groups do have a permanent presence in the country, and of course all of their staff and assets have been deployed in this effort, as well as local partner organizations that they normally work through, meaning churches, monasteries, and the local Red Cross, which has an extensive network. All of these people are working to push this relief out to the people who need it, but it is a huge challenge to get it quickly enough in sufficient quantities.
Richard Horsey, spokesman for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, we thank you for your time, and we wish you the best.
Thank you.
You got a tough road ahead.
Boy, they sure do. And you look at the geography there in Myanmar, and it's so low-lying that that water's going to be around for a while.
Barack Hussein Obama. They don't like for us to say his middle name, but it is his name. You know, West Virginia loved Bill Clinton, and, you know, to have him back in the White House, you can't tell me he's not going to help Hillary. And so I'm looking forward to that, you know.
As evidenced by the voice of that voter from West Virginia, which is the next primary in the Democratic presidential race, West Virginia is Clinton country. That's also evidenced by pieces of Pennsylvania and Indiana, which are part of the Appalachian region, which truly are a stronghold of Clinton support. What does that mean for the next primary that's coming up? There are 39 delegates up for grabs in West Virginia. The primary is next Tuesday. Anna Sale is part of a reporting team that has been following election year issues in the state at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us. Is West Virginia Hillary Clinton country for sure?
It certainly looks to be so. She's got a 29-point lead in a poll that came out on Monday.
Wow.
And that's pretty much how it's been since mid-March. There's still about 17% undecided, but Clinton has been strong here throughout.
Now, it would be wrong to say that these 39 delegates are going to be decisive in any sense. Hillary has enormous work cut out for her. But what does it mean that this region of the country seems to be so different or so sort of in some kind of a consensus about Hillary Clinton, or at least anti-Barack Obama? You hear that Barack Hussein Obama, and it gives you a little bit of the creeps on the back of your neck.
Yeah, I want to give a little context to that. That was from a small town in southern West Virginia in a county that's registered 86% Democrat. That's why I went down there to talk to voters to see what they were thinking, and I found a lot of suspicion about Barack Obama, not just his name. You heard comments about his race, and I also heard comments about his religion. They know that he says he's Christian, but I heard a lot of doubts and beliefs that he's actually Muslim. So that's something that still persists. Why this is the case in Appalachian counties, I can't tell you. I can tell you that in West Virginia, our demographics were 95% white. About 15% have a college degree. 25% of people in West Virginia don't have high school diplomas. So we really are kind of the poster child for the white working class vote. Mm-hmm. It's been talked about so much.
Big military contingent also in West Virginia, right?
Yeah, but more than 1 in 10 residents are veterans here.
So between now and next Tuesday, do you expect to see Barack Obama much in West Virginia?
Well, that's what's been interesting. His campaign has more offices open than Hillary Clinton does. They've been doing a lot of grassroots organizing. Barack Obama was here back in March and did two campaign appearances, one in the state capitol and one in southern West Virginia in the coal fields. He's not announced any campaign appearances yet next week, but he'll probably be here since we'll be in the spotlight. Meanwhile, the Clinton campaign has announced that Bill Clinton, Chelsea Clinton, and Hillary Clinton will be here over the next 3 days.
Oh, that's a hat trick, right? That's a Clinton hat trick, all three together.
All in different places, though, not together.
Anna Sale will be checking in with you between now and Tuesday. Anna Sale is from West Virginia Public Radio. West Virginia, of course, the site of the next primary, which comes up on Tuesday.
Interesting. It's very interesting. There's one great thing about this prolonged process, and that is so many states, so many voters in so many states have felt so critical to this entire process.
We also get to learn about all these states and how different they are. That's
indeed
also interesting. And, you know, the ground operation of Barack Obama, I mean, you got to hand it to them. They're so
absolutely
far behind, and wow. We've got responses. You have been weighing in with your suggestions, your slogan suggestions for the campaign. Vote Clinton, says Will Walker, because boomers haven't finished screwing up the United States yet. A little dark.
It's all downhill from here, says Alyssa. Not sure who she's thinking of. It could have been, might have been Clinton or Obama.
It's all downhill from here. We also have one from Spinbox at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Good morning. This is Troy Erickson calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota. Loving the takeaway, by the way, and I just wanted to offer my slogan for the campaign at this point. Hillary is in denial. Barack is more America style.
Not bad. And we are huge in Grand Forks. We are huge.
We love the ones that rhyme, especially when people come up with them so quickly, right?
I think that's good. You know, I am leaving you. I'm walking out of the studio and headed to California for 2 days.
You are not.
For 2 days,
not
yes.
At this exact moment, because first you have to hear from Mike Agronoff. He says, I'm always reminded when I hear slogans of a poster that I once saw that said to every... For every complex and knotty problem on this earth, there is a simple solution, and it's wrong. So I always distrust slogans.
Yeah, we wouldn't want him writing any. That wouldn't fit on any kind of bumper sticker, maybe an old Chrysler. Anyway, I'm out of here today.
Yes.
Headed to California for 2 days. Mm-hmm. We'll be reporting from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I'll be moderating a conference, the Sirius Play Conference in Pasadena. So we're gonna fill the show with eggheads tomorrow, maybe.
No, what is Sirius Play? Can you tell us about it?
It's a great design conference out at the Art Center College of Design, and it's basically about how creativity happens when you're able to seriously just play and let ideas happen. Kind of like we do on The Takeaway, right?
Yeah, I think
Sirius
that's
play.
Exactly what some people think we're doing.
Sometimes our play is really serious in here.
And sometimes it's not.
Sometimes it's not, yes.
So keep your slogans coming to mytake at thetakeaway.org or 1-877-8-MYTAKE.
And there's lots on our website. You can call our Spinbox line. Andrea Bernstein will be online later today, blogging about some of the places she's reported from in Indiana and what she thinks happened. Very interesting results. You also find us on Facebook and YouTube. Just search for The Takeaway.
.org. Yeah, because
yes.
We are a nonprofit organization.
Will you miss me? I'll actually be in your headphones. But...
Yeah, so you really won't be gone as far as I'm concerned.
Sweet.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.